From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor DeSantis signs into law a bill forcing local governments to make sure the unhoused don't wind up sleeping in public places.
And if they refuse, then you absolutely have the right to arrest them and remove them from being effectively a public nuisance at this place.
Also this week, Floridians stuck in a health insurance coverage gap are turning to voters for help.
My biggest fear is dying from something that would be survivable if I was just able to get typical annual checkups someone of my age gets.
We'll also get some reaction on the proposed federal TikTok ban and discover why certain Florida destinations love tourists, except for the ones who come during spring break. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Local officials are trying to figure out how to help unhoused people after the approval of a new law that bans municipalities from allowing camping on public property. As Lynn Hatter reports, supporters say the law encourages local communities to step up, but critics are questioning how that's supposed to happen when services are underfunded.
Local officials are trying to figure out how to help unhoused people after the approval of a new law that bans municipalities from allowing camping on public property. Supporters say the law encourages local communities to step up, but critics are questioning how that's supposed to happen when services are underfunded. I'm Lynn Hatter. The law blocks cities and counties from having rules that allow camping or sleeping in public spaces, like libraries and sidewalks. It's targeted at addressing homelessness in a state where more than 20,000 people slept outside last year, according to state estimates. Governor Ron DeSantis signed off on the new law during a press conference in Miami.
What you have here, what the mayor's doing, he's providing them, here's where you can go. And if they refuse, then you absolutely have the right to arrest them and remove them from being effectively a public nuisance at this place.
DeSantis has long criticized states like California, which has a large population of unhoused people, and he's vowed that Florida won't become like that.
And look, these are difficult issues. Some people fall on hard times. I know there's mental health issues running rampant. I know drug issues. These are difficult issues. But you should not be accosted by a homeless like we see. You should be able to walk down the street and live your life.
Leon County Commissioner Rick Miner says neither the city nor the county currently have anything on their books that allow the practice. Miner says the law shifts enforcement authority to local law enforcement.
For example, the sheriff's office is an independent constitutional office that makes its own prioritized decisions on how to enforce the law and when to make arrests. So it will be up to the sheriff's office here in Leon County and throughout all the sheriff's offices around the state to determine what actions they are going to take.
That, says Miner, effectively criminalizes a person for being homeless. During Senate debate over the measure, Orlando Democrat Geraldine Thompson accused the bill's backers of trying to hide rather than address the underlying problems that cause people to fall into homelessness.
Our focus of the bill is not about public property. It's about not wanting to see the failure in our society that has brought about homelessness.
The new law goes into effect in October, yet it's left many more questions than solutions. For one, the law does allow cities and counties to establish common camping areas for unhoused people. The sites would have to have access to sanitation, security, and mental health services, though some smaller rural counties would not have to provide that. The camps also cannot be located near businesses or residential areas, making it nearly impossible in some areas of the state with high population density. And citizens can sue municipalities that don't follow the law. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida is one of 10 states that has not expanded Medicaid eligibility under the Affordable Care Act. Advocates say that's left some Floridians in a loophole because they earn too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but too little for federal insurance subsidies. Now, as Regan McCarthy reports, advocates are working around the Republican-controlled legislature to bring the issue to voters with a proposed state constitutional amendment.
The group Florida Decides Healthcare kicked off its campaign on February 1st, which just happened to be J.J. Holmes' 20th birthday.
And the best gift I could get is for Florida to expand Medicaid.
Holmes has cerebral palsy. He uses an iPad to type out messages with his nose. His mom, Allison, is his full-time caregiver. He needs assistance with everything from eating and drinking to pulling the covers up at night when he gets cold. He says he's worried about his mom, who has arthritis and is almost 60.
Every day, I try as hard as I can to make it easier for her when she lifts me. But I know I'm hurting her, and I don't know what to do.
He has insurance because of his disability, but his mom doesn't. She says she stays awake at night worrying about what would happen to JJ if she got sick and couldn't afford to go to the doctor.
My biggest fear is dying from something that would be survivable if I was just able to get typical annual checkups someone of my age gets.
Holmes is in a so-called health insurance coverage gap. She has too much income to qualify for Medicaid in Florida, but too little to get subsidies from the health insurance marketplace. Without subsidies, an insurance policy could cost someone like Holmes at least $500 a month. She remembers having a health scare a few years ago. She's a U.S. citizen now, but came here in 2003 from Scotland, where she could get medical care for free.
It would have been cheaper for me to fly back to Britain and get checked out over there than to go to a doctor here.
Right now in Florida, for most adults in a family of three to get Medicaid, their income must be less than $8,000 a year. But to qualify for subsidies from the insurance marketplace, their annual income must be a minimum of about $26,000.
If you don't fit in those criteria, there's nothing available for you.
Jake Flaherty is the campaign director for Florida Decides Healthcare, the group pushing the proposed amendment. He says the aim of the Affordable Care Act, which passed in 2010, was to set up a health insurance exchange where people who didn't have insurance could purchase it. And the ACA would expand who qualifies for Medicaid, which is state and federally funded insurance for low-income people. But states pushed back, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the states could decide whether to expand Medicaid.
The ACA was broken. It doesn't work the way it was intended to.
Flaherty says the ACA, also referred to as Obamacare, quickly became political.
Most states that leaned left or Democratic quickly adopted Medicaid expansion. You did have some moderate and Republican states that got on board, too, just because it made sense and it got people covered. But you had a lot of resistance from folks just on the sort of this gut reaction against, you know, quote unquote, Obamacare.
Recently, North Carolina and South Dakota expanded Medicaid. In Florida, expansion has been a debate for more than a decade. This year, Florida Senate President Kathleen Pasadomo said it's a non-starter.
Medicaid expansion is not going to happen in Florida.
Allison Holmes says after years of waiting for lawmakers to take action, it's time to let the voters decide.
You know, you feel like you're walking on a tightrope with no safety net underneath. And it wouldn't take much to put that safety net for me and for all the other caregivers in Florida and everybody else who's been left in this limbo.
Estimates for the cost to expand Medicaid in Florida differ. Some say it's a major cost, others a significant savings. To get the proposal on the ballot in 2026, organizers have to collect nearly 1 million petition signatures. Then, once the Florida Supreme Court approves the language of the measure, 60% of voters are needed to amend the Constitution. I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
Coming up on Capitol Report, a new Florida law pulls the plug on local bodies that deal with ethics violations by government officials.
The one agency that could, you know, that could take these referrals and act upon them and, you know, send them out to different agencies, the ability to do that no longer exists.
As debate continues about a ban on the social media site TikTok, it seems not everyone, even among young people, is necessarily a big fan.
They're not necessarily accredited sources. They're not trustworthy.
Is synthetic meat a powerful tool in the fight against hunger, or is it a threat to our traditional way of life?
One of the challenges that we face with innovation in food, and especially when it challenges the existing ways in which we produce food, is not really knowing what's coming, right?
And we'll find that not every Florida destination that has spring breakers visit is enthused about the whole thing.
Tourism is still the economic engine. It doesn't matter if you're local or state.
Local Ethics Commission officials across the state are concerned that legislation awaiting Governor Ron DeSantis' signature could gut their ability to fight corruption. Tristan Wood reports they're also outraged at the atypical way the controversial bill passed the legislature.
The bill adds time limits to the length of ethics investigations, requires sworn affidavits to launch ethics complaints, and bans secondhand knowledge from being used in investigations. It also allows those running for public office to seek civil damages when someone files a fraudulent complaint. John Reed, general counsel for the Tallahassee Independent Ethics Board, says the legislation keeps boards from providing anonymous whistleblower protections to anyone that might be fearful of retribution for coming forward.
We would not even be able to look into the issue until somebody gave us a sworn complaint. So we might know that fraud is taking place. We might know that corruption is right in front of our eyes. But now under this bill, Senate Bill 7014, we'll be completely powerless to do anything about it.
While Tallahassee has a small local ethics board, the legislation will have a more sweeping impact on larger municipalities. Jose Arojo is the executive director of the Miami-Dade County Commission on Ethics and Public Trust, which oversees ethics complaints in the county and its 34 municipalities. Currently, they only receive about 50 sworn complaints a year, but receive hundreds of anonymous complaints through their tip line and other ways to protect whistleblowers. Arojo says the law will completely change the scope of how his department can serve the public.
You know, I think the citizens of Miami-Dade County have lost a repository for complaints of ethical misconduct. You know, the one agency that could take these referrals and act upon them and, you know, send them out to different agencies. The ability to do that no longer exists for the citizens of Miami-Dade County, at least not with their ethics commission.
The changes criticized by the local ethics officials were added to the bill by Zephyr Hills Republican Senator Danny Burgess. He argued on the Senate floor that the changes were to keep ethics commissions from being utilized for political purposes.
Somebody could just call a tip line hotline, pick up the phone and say, hey, this person's doing X, Y, and Z, hang up the phone and then immediately maybe call the media and tip that off that a complaint was made, and then the whole thing spirals out of control. And
some advocacy groups disagree that Burgess's reasoning is enough to justify the bill. Amy Keith, executive director of Common Cause Florida, pointed out that almost 79% of Floridians backed a constitutional amendment in 2018 that made stricter ethics rules in the state. She believes that's evidence that the public would not approve of the new changes.
Floridians want transparent, accountable, and ethical officials. So I don't think this bill is about minimizing frivolous complaints or any of that. I think it's about making complaints almost impossible, and I think that undermines the will of the people of Florida.
Common Cause is calling on Governor Ron DeSantis to veto the legislation. They not only take issue with what the bill does, but how the bill was passed. The controversial changes added by Burgess came after the bill passed its final committee stop, meaning the public couldn't comment on the changes.
Not only did we see, cutting off of avenues for ethics complaints to move forward, but we also saw the way that these bills came about was cutting off the ability of public citizens to be part of that deliberative process in committee, about these provisions and the impact they would have. And that's something we certainly hope that the governor will look at and we'll see.
Burgess has not yet responded to a request for comment on why his amendment came after the committee process. I'm Tristan Wood.
Just before we went to air with this edition of Capitol Report, we received this statement from the office of Senate President Pasadomo. And I quote, "I believe that state and local ethics boards should be able to spend their time investigating serious violations of our ethics laws, not politically motivated public relations stunts designed to generate headlines. All too often, the current process is weaponized by bad actors. Anonymous complaints based on hearsay consume more resources than ones that are brought by a witness or backed up by information or documentation that can be corroborated. Much of what has been said and written about the bill is mischaracterized. It does not require personal knowledge. A complaint based on a campaign treasurer's reports, for example, would be permitted, and it does not prevent referrals from someone like a state attorney or an inspector general. The standards in the bill are not entirely new. Plenty of local ethics boards already require sworn complaints based on the standard in the bill, and I have concerns that in other jurisdictions, the self-initiation powers are or could be politicized and weaponized, especially if inadmissible hearsay is allowed and the commission can order and enforce its own penalties. Ultimately, I've supported the bill because I think it's important to have some uniformity and consistent standards for public officials that may be subjected to complaints. And that statement comes to us from Senate President Kathleen Passidomo. The U.S. government wants to crack down on the popular app TikTok. The U.S. Senate could soon vote on a bill to force the sale of the app or lead to it being banned in the country. As Alexandra Dressner reports, in Florida, TikTok users are having mixed reactions.
Earlier this month, the House of Representatives passed legislation to prompt the owners of TikTok to sell the app. Otherwise, it will be banned in the United States. President Joe Biden has announced that he will sign the bill into law if it passes the Senate. TikTok is owned by ByteDance, a company based in China. The United States government believes the social media app poses a security threat. That concern is shared by David Merrick. He is the director of the Emergency Management and Security Program at Florida State University.
Aside from what's being collected, it can be used as a tool for misinformation and disinformation.
Merrick says the biggest concern of lawmakers is that China can use the app to plant misinformation, particularly during an election season. TikTok collects data, such as users' locations and interests, but so do a lot of companies, says Merrick.
There's a lot of American companies or European companies or any things that are collecting the same or more information and then selling it. So will banning TikTok improve security in the United States? No, probably not.
A lot of people use TikTok more than they use Google.
TikTok user and FAMU student Cameron Harper says banning TikTok would take away a prominent resource that she and others use to receive information.
I kind of found out how to turn that off like a long time ago, where it's like to let them read the data. I forgot what it was called, but somebody else had made a video about that on TikTok as well. That's what I'm saying. Like, they put a lot of important stuff on it.
FSU student McDaniel Summerall says he won't miss TikTok if it gets banned. He supports the initiative by lawmakers to force a sale, and he thinks a lot of what users see on the app is misinformation.
You know, a lot of these TikTokers or influencers, they're not necessarily accredited sources. They're not trustworthy. They're not journalists, you know, so it's untrustworthy.
Last year, the state of Florida attempted to block the app on public school-owned Wi-Fi networks and devices, but that's had little effect on students using the app. They currently circumvent it by using their private data plans on their cell phones. And should a federal ban pass, Summerall believes there are ways around that too, like using VPNs or virtual private networks.
It's like you can change your IP address, you could log in, say you're in China or whatever, you know, so.
Still, he believes the overall effort to curb TikTok is worth it. This is not the only one facing scrutiny. The U.S. Supreme Court recently heard lawsuits over data privacy and content moderation policies at X, formerly Twitter, and Facebook. It's all part of a growing concern over how much influence such platforms have on both public opinion and perception. I'm Alexandra Dresner.
During the 2024 session, Florida lawmakers approved legislation that would prohibit the manufacturing for sale and distribution of what's called cell-cultivated or lab-grown meat. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved lab-grown meat cultivation last year, but it's far from hitting the grocery store shelves or restaurant plates. To get some context on this new food science industry and why a state legislature might already be banning it at this stage, WGCU's Mike Canary talked with Dr. Jennifer Martin. She's an associate professor in meat science and quality at Colorado State University.
Plant-based meats have sort of made a surge, but they're still a tiny percentage compared to, you know, conventional meat products. And this seems like it's even further out and, you know, obviously a much even smaller percentage. Were you at all surprised when you saw that, you know, Florida lawmakers, you know, passed legislation about this new industry at this stage in the game?
It is a little surprising. I think, though, it speaks to the social construct of food and then the intersection of the consumer and the producer of the food, and specifically in the space of agriculture. And so the lens where I view this challenge, and I'm getting lots of questions from policymakers and folks who are curious about potential policy impacts, really stems from, what does this mean for the traditional livestock producer who raises animals that are going into a meat production chain and they're producing beef cattle for steaks or ground beef or, you know, birds for chicken nuggets or chicken breast? There's a social construct to how our food is produced, and specifically those people who are producing it and their roles that they play not only within communities, but also within the larger landscape, both economically and socially within their region, their state, and arguably nationally. And so I think we're seeing a lot of interest in policies to preserve that social construct that we have currently. One of the challenges that we face with innovation in food, and especially when it challenges the existing ways in which we produce food, is not really knowing what's coming, right? With the plant-based meat products, relatively speaking, as you alluded to, the market share is really small. And so we really didn't see much of a change in traditional-based meat proteins when the plant-based products came on the market. But in this space, there's a lot of interest, perhaps concern of, will cultivated meats take over for traditionally produced meat proteins? And if that happens, what are the economic implications, the societal implications, the cultural implications of that happening? And so I think we've seen policy that is saying, let's consider what happens if we replace the, you know, a significant contributor of our GDP, for example, or our gross state product with, get rid of ag in that space that is currently usually in the top five for many of our states and get rid of it. What does that mean for our state? And maybe we should examine that before we move forward.
Have you yourself tried any lab grown or cultivated meats?
I have at a conference that I attended a couple of years ago. It was fun, right? It was something that, again, it's that the intersection that I have from a scientific perspective and my fascination with the science, as well as the science or analytical part of my brain that's used to working in the traditional meat space. And I'm making those comparisons to, you know, how does this compare to a chicken nugget, or how does this compare to something that I've tried in other spaces, and how, you know, how might consumers who are used to eating something else compare? So I really appreciated the opportunity to try it at that conference, just from a pure science enthusiast perspective, and then to put my meat scientist hat on to really think about, wow, all of the really cool opportunities that exist to do research and to ask some questions that we're interested in answering from a research perspective.
How was it?
I thought it was really good. I didn't, frankly, I mean, you know what it is. So my expectations were for it to be different. And there were some differences that I noticed, but I don't think it was something, this is a question that I have, right? So as a person who has done a lot of research in consumer science and sensory science, specifically in traditional meat proteins, I was able to pick up on some differences. But could the average consumer? That's a question I would love to ask of these products and comparing them to traditional products. I thought it was, for what I was expecting, for it to taste grossly different, I was really impressed with the ability of it to get close to what a traditional product would taste like and what that experience would be like.
That was WGCU's Mike Canary talking with Dr. Jennifer Martin. She's an associate professor in meat science and quality at Colorado State University. Florida's unemployment rate held at 3.1% in February for the third consecutive month. That even as job losses were posted in many industry sectors. The unemployment rate held as a growing labor force continues to counter the number of people who are out of work. The Florida Department of Commerce today estimated 345,000 Floridians qualified as unemployed in February. That was up 5,000 from January and up 44,000 from the same time last year. Meanwhile, the labor force increased by 217,000 over the past year. The national unemployment rate was 3.9% in February. That was up from 3.7% in January. Governor Ron DeSantis says Florida jobless rate has been lower than the national mark for 40 consecutive months.
People are moving here, and they've been moving here for many years now. And why not? Florida, we're number one for new business formations, 4 years running.
The state's unemployment rate in February 2023 was 2.8%. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, cities across Florida are making attempts to crack down on spring break. The state's efforts come after college kids have spent years partying and causing mischief in many of Florida's beach towns. Adrian Andrews has more on what the state is now doing to keep people safe.
Spring break season is far from over. College kids are traveling to Florida for its beaches and warm weather, but with that come many risks. In a cell phone video taken from a Florida A&M college student, you can hear hundreds of teens partying over Miami's Ocean Drive. This comes a week after the city of Miami announced it was imposing curfews, bag checks, and raising fees to punish spring breakers for bad behavior. Like most of the state, authorities in Miami Beach, Panama City, and Daytona are rolling out initiatives to stop tourists from trashing the place. Governor Ron DeSantis says this year he's also deploying heavy reinforcement.
We've seen spring break come. We've seen a lot of people here. But you have not seen what you've seen in years past.
This week, during a bill signing, the governor compared the state's homeless problem to young adults coming in for the week and acting reckless. He says Florida's streets have become too crowded with unwanted visitors. As a result, he's sending 140 state troopers to 17 cities across the state to, quote, keep the area safe.
We have to govern this state and our communities with an eye towards what's in the best interest of the law-abiding citizen.
Florida's Attorney General Ashley Moody also has something to say about spring breakers. At a presser in Daytona, Moody says young adults are typically throwing parties, which opens the door for illegal drugs. She's calling for officers at the Volusia County Sheriff's Department to stack up on naloxone, which is a medicine that rapidly reverses an opioid overdose.
Many equate spring break with drug use, and we have got to stop that because we now know that so many illicit substances contain a lethal dose of fentanyl.
Some businesses are also shutting down early due to locally imposed curfews. In a 2019 interview with WFSU, Carol Dover, the CEO of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, says the money made from tourists during spring break can help smaller towns grow.
Tourism is still the economic engine. It doesn't matter if you're local or state. So you need tourists in your community to continue to bring the sales tax revenue, the bed tax revenue.
I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Alexandra Dressner and Mike Canary. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.